Hello, and welcome to Literally from the North Shore. Thank you for tuning in. Today, we will continue with Tom Kohler's reading of Minnesota author Dean Hovey's book, Whistling Pines, a lighthearted mystery set in a fictional Two Harbors senior care facility. We'll pick up where Tom left off last time.
How can you promise him bagpipes? I squawked as she punched off the speakerphone. I don't have bagpipes coming. I don't even have the prospect of bagpipes. Peter, don't have a heart attack. By the time Enos gets everyone to the church, it'll be too late for him to turn back. Wendy spun and walked out the door. I need him to drive them back here after the funeral, too, I yelled at her back. I almost bowled over Len Rents as I rushed through the door. Who's driving back from the funeral? He asked. Wendy's cousin, Enos, is driving the seasick sailor's band bus to the funeral. He's going to bring a couple of loads of residents to the Lutheran church. They own that big red bus that has Oompa-pa written across the sides. I've seen them play a couple times, and they put on quite a show. You could do worse than having them play at the funeral. Len paused a beat and then asked, Are you getting them instead of the bagpiper? No, there is no bagpiper, and the seasick sailors won't be playing either. It's probably just as well that you're not having the band. They really were Great Lakes sailors, and they tend to be a little randy at times. From what I hear, they could have given Axel philandering lessons. You know that old saying about musicians. I suddenly had a very disturbing picture of the seven seasick sailors chasing my little old ladies around with carnal intentions. The scariest part was that most of my residents would be flattered. No, I don't know the saying about musicians, and I don't care to, I replied, letting my overall irritation spill onto Len. Did you have something special, Len? I'm way behind with the funeral plans, and I don't have time for idle chatter right now. How are you doing with the inside snooping job? Len asked. He pulled a pipe and tobacco pouch from his pocket. You can't smoke in here. It's a state law. Len clamped the unlit pipe in his teeth and inhaled deeply with his eyes closed. I know, but sometimes I just need to get a whiff of tobacco to get the rush. I shook my head. I think that means you're not physically addicted. It makes no difference whether it's psychological or physical. I still want it. Len folded the tobacco pouch and put it back into his pocket. Back to my original question. What have you heard? He asked, the pipe still clenched between his teeth. I had an interesting talk with my neighbor, Dolores, I said, leading Len into my office and closing the door behind us. It seems that she and her late husband got the best of Axel in court after a land deal went south on them. She said that someone came to them after that to get some direction on dealing with Axel. I guess the guy had some plans, but he mysteriously died in a duck hunting accident. Yeah, Len said, I know about Hank Cook. The coroner ruled his death an accidental drowning, although I think he didn't look much further once he found water in the victim's lungs. Was there more to investigate? I thought it odd that Axel Olson was in the boat with Hank, but didn't even get damp during his attempted rescue efforts, especially considering that Axel and Hank were in the middle of a contentious court fight. Hank went duck hunting with Axel when they were fighting in court? I asked. That does seem odd. Yep, even Hank's wife was surprised. She thought he was going hunting alone and was more than surprised that he was with Axel. She said they didn't even like to eat ducks. Has anyone else given you any other insights? Len asked, once more fidgeting with the pipe, moving it from one side of his mouth to the other. I've been a little busy with my job. The funeral planning is really chewing me up. Everybody seems to want something, and they think that tomorrow will be too late. Len said, looking at my screensaver, flashing irregular patterns that reminded me of the Northern Lights. I got a call back from one of Stella's Finnish neighbors this morning. He was the guy who made all the arrangements for the Great Lakes tour and made sure that everyone made it to the buses and the boat on time. The actual date of Stella's birthday party was dictated by when their boat docked in Duluth. He'd arranged for a van to drive them to two harbors. Most of the Finns were Stella's octogenarian cousins, with a couple younger people to assist with the canes, walkers, oxygen bottles, and wheelchairs. They don't sound like the kind of people who'd be murderers. Len smiled. I learned a long time ago that appearances deceive. I don't suppose he told you that one of his people killed Axel? Actually, his response was, who is this Axel person? I explained Axel's Finnish link, and he said that he'd never heard of Axel. They had quite an experience after they left Duluth. The ship was struck with some stomach virus, and nearly half the passengers and crew were down with miserable intestinal distress that held them up in Thunder Bay for 2 days while they washed the whole ship with disinfectant. I read that in the newspaper. I hope they didn't spread any of the virus around here, or the state health department will have this place quarantined so fast it'll make your head spin. There was a quiet knock on the door, and Len had to sit down in my lone visitor chair so I could squeeze past him. I was surprised to see Howard Johnson standing there with a look of concern. Peter, I know that you're busy with the funeral plans, but something has come up that needs your attention. Dozens of terrible situations passed through my mind during Howard's short pause. A number of the ladies are concerned that they don't have appropriate clothing for a spring funeral, and they need you to take them in the van to Duluth so they can shop at the mall. Len chuckled as he stuck his face around the door. In the greater scheme of things, a trip to the mall isn't much of an emergency. You go down and explain that to a dozen angry hens, Howard replied tersely. I patted Howard on the arm and said, tell them that I'm busy, but I promise that I will find someone to drive them to Duluth tomorrow afternoon. Thank you, Peter. I'm not entirely sure how I was elected to deliver this message, but I'm certain that my afternoon would have been miserable if you hadn't given the okay. Howard, would the ladies have put Axel up to a chore like this? Len asked. Howard snorted. They wouldn't ask Axel for the time of day. He had a tendency to give ungentlemanly responses to anything that might inconvenience him. So Axel wasn't just tight with his money? Len asked. Oh, no, Axel didn't want to be involved in anything that didn't benefit Axel. In his mind, minor inconveniences were major annoyances, and he tended to suffer with profane tirades to spread his pain to as many innocent bystanders as possible. I'm surprised you ever left his room, Len observed. You don't understand Axel, Howard explained. He had to be around people, making himself appear superior, always more important. If we sang in the community room, we sang his choice of songs. When we watched television, we watched what Axel wanted to see at the volume Axel wanted to hear it. If someone was talking nearby while Axel was watching television, he turned the volume up until he couldn't hear them, or until they left. Axel wouldn't play bingo, I added, because he didn't win all the time. When he lost, he tended to throw the cards and storm out. I'm surprised that someone didn't throw him out, Len said. I'm surprised that someone didn't kill him long ago, Howard replied as he turned and walked away. Howard, Len called after the departing senior, is there anyone who didn't play along with Axel's drama? Didn't play along? I don't understand your question. It sounds like most of you were too polite to call Axel on his behavior. Is there someone who wouldn't play along with his dramatics? Len said. You know, someone who just walked away when Axel showed up, or showed particular animosity towards him? Howard seemed to be dumbstruck by the question. Slowly, a smile crossed his face. I see. You want to know if there was someone who is a strong, silent type. You're not worried about the baying bassets among us. You want to find the silent killer who doesn't act out, kind of like a guard dog who doesn't bark, just bites. The canine metaphor aside, is there someone who didn't put up with Axel's antics? Len asked. Is there someone who quietly slipped away when Axel became profane? There are a number of women who don't socialize much in the common areas, but I doubt that they stay in their rooms to avoid Axel. A couple of the men tend to stay in their rooms to watch television without the background noise downstairs. A few people are just introverted and don't feel comfortable in the groups downstairs and aren't seen except at mealtime. Most of the women who work in the dining room wouldn't turn their backs on him, I offered. He pinched or groped most of them, so they tended to go back away from him when they served his table. Angie growled at him when she got near him, and she made it pretty clear that she wouldn't put up with his nonsense, and Miriam almost broke his wrist when he put his hand on her thigh. "Is Angie the cook with the tattoos?" Len asked. "Yep," I replied. "I've met her, and I think she'd slap him silly or give him a piece of her mind rather than waiting until he was alone and then killing him. We're looking for someone who's more like a pressure cooker, someone who keeps it all pent up inside until one day he just blew and killed Axel." "I don't know who that would be," Howard replied. Whistling Pines, Chapter 19. I looked for Wendy, hoping to coerce her into driving the van to Duluth for the shopping outing. As usual, Wendy was never to be found when I needed her. I found her in the hair salon, chatting with a stylist and Edith McElroy, who was getting a lavender tint. "Wendy, could you do me a favor?" Since Wendy was the assistant director, I had to couch my request as a favor. "Peter, the last time I did you a favor, I ended up fishing Edna's dentures out of the toilet. Not that it did any good. She never put them back in her mouth again anyway." "I'm up to my eyeballs in the funeral plans, and I need you to drive the van to Duluth tomorrow. A few of the women want to buy new funeral clothes." "Will I have to babysit them, or can I just turn them loose and do some shopping of my own?" Wendy asked. "I usually drop the people off at the Herberger's entrance and tell everyone to synchronize watches. We meet at the same entrance in 2 hours, and I spend the time in the music shop looking for new songbooks and guitars. 15 minutes before the departure time, I retrieve the van and park at the same drop point. The people straggle out with their bags, and I help them get loaded back on the van. Some return exhausted and a little early, and some others show up a couple minutes late." "They are independent and unsupervised?" Wendy asked. "I don't want to spend my afternoon babysitting. Most of all, I don't want surprises." "Hey, what can go wrong with a van full of senior citizens?" I joked. "Take your book of New York Times crossword puzzles and relax at the coffee kiosk. I'll leave the van keys on my desk." I hear my name came up in the murder investigation. I recognized Angie's raspy voice at my office door. "You came up only in the context that you were one of the people who actually stood up to Axel, not as a suspect," I replied, pushing away from the computer. "Well, that's good, because I wouldn't kill anyone." She stood leaning against the door frame with her arms crossed. She wore a stained white apron, a short-sleeved white blouse, and white jeans. Her rose tattoo showed on her right wrist. The butterfly on her other wrist was hidden under her folded arms. The stud in her nose and the safety pin through her eyebrows were distracting. I had to try hard not to stare at them when I spoke. "I think we know that." Angie gave an emphatic nod. "Good, I'm glad we're clear on that." She continued to stand in the doorway with her arms crossed. "Is there something else?" I asked, glancing back at my computer, thinking about all the work I had left to do. "Axel had something else going on." I waited for her to go on. "He was rich, you know, so a lot of the residents were asking him about ways to make money. I think that he may have been investing money for them." "Most of the residents were retired railroad workers, farmers, and their wives who were living off Social Security and meager savings." "Oh, man, I thought we had enough suspects with the folks around town that Axel had crossed," I moaned. "Don't forget whoever he's been screwing." You've heard the rumors? Do you think they're true? I know that the kitchen staff have seen women sneaking in and out of his room when they delivered meals to sick residents or when they picked up the dishes. Do you have any names? I'm not a tattletale, she replied over her shoulder as she left. I turned to the computer and polished off the activity schedule for the following week and printed it. After posting the schedule in the lobby, I realized that a headache was starting to creep into my forehead. I tried to remember if I'd had any caffeine and decided that I was probably 2 cups behind on my daily ration of coffee. Wendy looked up from her crossword puzzle as I drew a cup of coffee from the urn near the kitchen. I need a 9-letter word for beggar, she said, tapping her pencil on the tabletop. I tried panhandler, but that's 10 letters. Mendicant, I replied as I poured a dollop of cream into the coffee. I knew the coffee wouldn't help much because it looked and smelled like coal tar. I suspected that all the caffeine had been burned out. Wendy looked at me skeptically. How do you spell it? M-E-N-D-I-C-A-N-T, I replied. She wrote the letters down as I spoke them and then stared at the puzzle. Peter, why do you know that word? I missed it in the 6th grade spelling bee, I replied. It's etched indelibly in my memory like a childhood scar. If that's your worst scar, your childhood was pretty mild. Preteen girls are vicious. They're all terribly insecure, and they try to feel better by making someone else's life miserable. It doesn't stop at teens, Jenny added, having swept into the room behind my back. Adult women can be catty, too. Isn't it nice that the high-paid staff gets to sit around drinking coffee and talking about teen insecurities when there are about 100 people who rely on you, roaming the hallways unsupervised? I didn't recognize the middle-aged man who had walked into the dining room. He was around 60 years old, with a halo of frizzy white hair ringing his bald pate. He wore a white shirt that strained to hold his ample stomach and a pair of khaki pants. The only discordant portion of his attire was a pair of reddish-brown stained work boots, which hinted that he had something to do with the iron mining industry. "Can I help you, sir?" Jenny asked. "I think it's a little late for that," he replied. "If you'd been more watchful, my father might still be alive." He limped into the room, favoring his left leg and grimacing with each step. He pulled a chair from the table nearest us and sat down. "Can I get you a cup of coffee, Mr. Olson?" Wendy asked as she slipped the crossword puzzle under the tablecloth. "That would be the least you could do at this point," the man replied. This must be Axel Olson's middle child, I thought. I'd never seen him in person. None of Axel's children had ever previously darkened the halls of Whistling Pines. "Are you Darrell Olson?" I asked. "I recall your father speaking about you." "My name is Darren," the man replied with disdain, "and I doubt that my father ever mentioned me." He paused for a second, then added, "Unless my name was preceded by a string of expletives." Wendy handed Darren Olson a cup of coffee, and he took it from her hand with a look that he might have given a leper. He didn't bother to thank her. "I suppose you must be Peter, the incompetent idiot who's trying to find someone to play bagpipes at Axel's funeral. Len Rents suggested that I stop here to talk to you." If anyone else had addressed me like that, I would have been insulted, but in the case of Darren Olson, it was easy to consider the source and dismiss the insult. "Mr. Olson, are you here to provide some input on the funeral arrangements?" Jenny asked, trying to redirect the conversation. "If it was up to me, he'd be cremated and his ashes scattered at the landfill. No, I wouldn't make the trip to the landfill. It'd be easier just to put the ashes into the garbage and let the truck take him there." Even I was struck dumb, and I looked to Jenny, whose mouth was gaping. Wendy was the only one who had a response. "We've reserved the Lutheran church for the funeral," she said. Darren made a face like he'd sucked a lemon. "If you can find a church that'd take him, either alive or dead, Go for it. He paused as he was obviously framing his thoughts and then added, It seems like whatever building a coven uses for meetings would be more fitting. I don't know what you'd call that. Maybe a witch's cave? Lutherans are pretty tolerant, Wendy said. I don't need your flippant sarcasm, Darren said, rising from the chair with a great effort. I'll be at the church, but don't expect me or any of my siblings to shed any tears. As Darren Olson walked out the door, Wendy turned to Jenny and me. I think that went pretty well, don't you? She sat down, picked up her pencil, and started looking at the crossword puzzle as if the issue was decided. I looked at Jenny, who was actually looking a little sad. I don't appreciate people who air their family's dirty laundry. You missed the conversation I had with Axel's daughter, I said. It went much the same way. Jenny closed her eyes. I don't think I can deal with this stress over the funeral. My stomach is in knots. I'm getting by on 3 or 4 hours of sleep, worrying about a murderer roaming the halls. Wendy, apparently oblivious to our conversation, was tapping her pencil in deep thought over something in the crossword. Blackberry brandy, she suddenly blurted. What? I asked. Jenny needs blackberry brandy. It settles your stomach and helps you sleep, Wendy said, and then added, It also helps with irregularity. Jenny leaned close and whispered, That a man seemed angry enough to be a murderer. I nodded and thought Darren would be near the top of the suspect list. Whistling Pines, Chapter 20. The smell of pipe tobacco wafted through my office, preceding Lynn's arrival. Anything new? Axel's son Darren was here today. He's quite a piece of work. He suggested that we have Axel cremated and the ashes hauled away with the garbage. The whole family is cracked, Len said. It's like that Johnny Cash song about a guy who named his son Sue to harden him in preparation for dealing with the world. From all appearances, that's pretty much what Axel did to all three of his children. He set them all up in businesses, but seemed to wring or extort repayment with usurious interest from them, and did all he could to make sure they came close to failing. Axel was quite a guy, was all I could add. That's not all. He may not have been able to take it with him, but somehow he seems to have tied it up or hidden all his money so no one else can get it, Len added. I don't understand what you're saying. Axel set up some sort of blind trust that ties up all his property and money. No one has the authority to liquidate any of his real estate, nor can they sell any of the securities. If they try to contest the will, they are cut out of any inheritance. So who wins? I can't figure it out, Len replied. I've been trying to follow the money because that is certainly where the biggest motive lies, but it doesn't look like anyone wins right now. There is an interesting clause in Axel's will that directs the trustee to give $1 million payment to the first of his children who makes $1 million. Right now, it doesn't appear that any of the children are in a business that will ever make that milestone. Who's the trustee? I asked. The lawyer didn't recognize the name. It's a woman from the Twin Cities. He's trying to contact her. Money or not, I said. Darren Olson seemed angry enough to kill someone. Axel's daughter was here earlier, and she was as bitter as Darren, although a lot of her rant had less vitriol than the son's bitterness. My head was still buzzing from the conversation with Darren Olson and Len's news about Axel's will when I walked to my car after work. The wind had died, and the dampness that had chilled me to the bone most of the week had given way to a drier coolness. I thought about all the things that needed to be accomplished before the funeral and felt overwhelmed. Snuffy Sorry was polishing his yellow and black 57 Chevy in the residence parking lot. The ever-present bulging wad of Copenhagen snuff was tucked under his lower lip. He had little color in his life except his Chevy, which he cleaned endlessly. Unlike most of the cars in the lot, Snuffy's Chevy was free of rust and fender dents except for a severely rumpled rear bumper. "The car is looking good," I said as I passed. Snuffy nodded without changing expression. "I'm just glad that we're past the salt season on the roads. That salt is sure hard on the fenders," he replied with his thick Finnish accent as he rubbed a stained towel on a non-existent blemish on the trunk. "Yeah, but if they don't put salt on the streets, we'd all be playing bumper cars on the ice for 6 months of the year," I replied, pointing to the twist in his bumper, "kind of like you did there." Snuffy's expression darkened. "That wasn't no accident," he said, spitting Copenhagen juice for emphasis. He turned away and went back to polishing. I heard Jenny calling my name. She was hustling across the driveway, her briefcase flopping against her hip. Snuffy was immediately forgotten. "I think we should go out to the American Legion Hall for dinner tonight. It's pasty night," Jenny said, taking my hand in hers, "and then we can go out to Hugo's to hear Wendy's band." "I guess that's okay. I tried to remember the last time I'd eaten a pasty. The hearty meat and potato mixture folded in a pie crust. Pasties had been a lunch bucket staple for the Iron Range miners, and they remained a favorite regional comfort food. Will they have gravy?" "Peter, everyone eats ketchup on pasties. I like gravy better." "Get over it. They'll have ketchup. What time do we pick up Jeremy?" "I talked to my mother. She picked him up from school, and they're eating fish sticks and green beans, his favorites." She mistook my lost look for disinterest and added, "But if you've got other plans..." "No," I said a little too sharply. I softened my face and took her other hand in mine. I was just lost in other thoughts. The funeral planning is eating me up. Jenny leaned close and brushed her lips against mine. "Let it go for tonight and have dinner with me. Then we can drive out to hear Wendy's band." "Get a room," Wendy yelled across the parking lot. She was grinning broadly as she climbed into her vintage bright yellow VW Beetle. I traced Jenny's jawline with the tip of my finger, eliciting a shiver. I kissed the tip of her nose and pulled her close. We could skip supper and just go back to my place for dessert.
You've been listening to Episode 9 of Whistling Pines by Minnesota author Dean Hovey. There will be a total of 15 episodes in this reading, so be sure to tune in again next time for more from Whistling Pines. If you miss an episode during the reading of this book, you may find the previous week's episodes posted each weekend on our website, ktwh.org, under the Programs tab near the top of the home page. Just look for Literally from the North Shore on the drop-down menu under Programs.